is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, Johnny Cash was born. And so we're going to spend the next hour talking about his life, playing his music, hearing from his son, hearing from other artists playing his music, and hearing from Rick Rubin, the man who resuscitated this life and career and act and art. A remarkable story. But when you're telling a story, you've got to start at the beginning. Born in Kingsland, Arkansas, the son of poor Southern Baptist sharecroppers, Cash was one of seven children born to Ray and Carrie Rivers Cash. They moved with his family at the age of three to Dicey's, Arkansas, so that his father could take advantage of the New Deal farming programs instituted by President Roosevelt. There, the Cash clan lived in a five-room house and farmed 20 acres of cotton and other seasonal crops. We went into the vault to dig out some clips, and here's Johnny talking about his childhood in Arkansas in those cotton fields, about the house that he was born in.
February 26, 1932, in a little house surrounded by cotton fields. My father was a cotton farmer, walked behind the mules with the plow, and I did that as well. It was a family thing. Everybody in the family worked in the fields. Even the girls did. There's some sweet memories and some sad memories too, but it was a good life.
But it was a good life. It was a hard life. But the hardest thing that happened to Johnny was losing his older brother, and a star older brother, one he really looked up to. Here's Johnny's son, John Carter Cash, talking about his dad and his dad's brother.
If it hadn't been for losing Jack, there's no telling if he ever would have gone on to sing the songs that he sang with such heartache, you know, related to so many people, you know, his suffering so easily because it was on his sleeve. He had a great understanding and closer spiritual relationship with God because he came in and studied in Jack's stead. And though he continued to sing and followed his heart's desire in music, he still delved even deeper into studying the Bible, my father did, in life, because I believe that he had that desire to be who he believed Jack would have been.
And he believed Jack would have been a pastor and a man of the cloth. Here's John Carter Cash, again, Johnny's son, talking about his dad's love of gospel music. This is the first music he ever fell in love with. You're also going to hear in this clip from Marshall Grant from the Tennessee Two, who was in the room that fateful day Cash auditioned in Memphis for Sam Phillips.
My father's greatest desire when he got into the music business, he wanted to sing gospel songs on the radio. And I think, you know, I think it was only later on that he realized that you know, he might be actually making records in the studio and that they'd be recorded. He just wanted to sing on the radio.
When we went to audition for Sam Phillips, it was still gospel music that we wanted to do. And we auditioned for Sam Phillips at Sun Records with a song called I Was There When It Happened. So I guess I ought to know.
Well, I was there when it happened, and so I guess I ought to know.
And if you remember in that scene from Walk the Line, Joaquin Phoenix walks into that studio. He sings that song. Sam Phillips is just shaking his head. He doesn't buy what Johnny's selling. And, well, here's the exchange in that movie.
We come down here, we play for a minute, and he tells me I don't believe in God.
You know exactly what I'm telling you. We've already heard that song 100 times. Just like that, just like how you were singing it.
Oh, you didn't let us bring it home.
Bring it home? All right, let's bring it home. If he was hit by a truck and you were lying out in that gutter dying and you had time to sing One song. Huh? One song people would remember before your dirt. One song that would let God know what you felt about your time here on earth. One song that would sum you up. You telling me that's the song you'd sing? That same Jimmy Davis tune we hear on the radio all day about your peace within and how it's real and how you're going to shout it? Or would you sing something different?
And my goodness, he started to sing something different. What's left out of Walk the Line, and we'll get into in subsequent segments in this hour, is that he did keep on singing gospel. But ultimately, this, not soon thereafter, not long after this exchange, was Johnny Cash's first number one song and the number one Billboard hit for him on the country charts. And here it is.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
Lyrics that weren't exactly shake, rattle, and roll. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. His Christian essence there, right from the beginning. The struggles between flesh and the spirit. A song about marital fidelity and his struggles with it. And he would have them. And he sung honestly about them. And so for the hour, the life of Johnny Cash, as you won't hear anyone else on Our American Stories, but Our American Stories. And that's why we do what we do for you. These are the stories you want to hear. When we come back, more on the life of Johnny Cash, born this day in history in 1932.
I walk the line. You've got a way to keep me on your side. You give me cause for love that I can't hide.
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, "Come and see." And I saw, and behold, a white horse.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Johnny Cash, being celebrated on this day in history.
There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around.
And that man, of course, to Johnny Cash was, well, we know who that man is. And Walk the Line did not get into this. And it was a great movie, but it stripped the animating force of Cash's life, and that was God, and that was Jesus Christ. And Johnny wrote about his sin. We learned that about Scalia, his sin. Christians have to talk about their sin, or they're not being honest. And this, if anything, Johnny Cash was. And I think that's the appeal. And this movie just focused on his love of June, but not on his love of Christ. And let me tell you, Johnny did. He recorded the entire King James Version of the New Testament. Did you know that? He performed at countless Billy Graham revivals, made a movie about the life of Jesus, and studied the Bible so much, he almost had a, well, I think he knew more about it than most divinity school PhDs. Somehow none of that made it to the screen. Let's take a listen to Johnny's reading of Matthew 7.
Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall.
None of it in the movie Walk the Line. Leaving out Cash's Christian faith from his life story would be like leaving out half-naked women from Hugh Hefner's. Or like telling the story of Jackie Robinson without ever mentioning race or segregation. You know, Cash was interviewed quite a number of times about his drug addiction. He spoke openly about his bouts with it and his selfishness. In one interview with Songwriter magazine, he said this, "You don't think about anyone else when you're on drugs. You think about yourself and where your next stash is coming from or your next drink. I wanted and wasted so much. I mean, we're not talking days I wasted. We're talking years, maybe decades." What a confession. Believers and non-believers alike know about such struggles. That's what attracted so many people to Cash's music, his humility, his empathy. Here's a story that should have been in the movie. It's out of his book, out of the book. And I think if you can read one book about Johnny Cash, it's called A Man Called Cash by Steve Turner. The book was supposed to be based on this. The movie was supposed to be based on this book, but my goodness, all the good stuff's not in the movie. Turns out Cash in the 1990s wanted to kill himself. And so he decided to go to Chattanooga, not far from his home, to a place called the Nickajack Caves, where he spent a lot of time. And he had spent time there early in his life hunting for treasures such as Indian arrowheads and items left behind by Confederate soldiers. But on this occasion, again, he was looking to end his life. This is what he told writer Nick Toschies in 1995. And again, what a scene this would have made in the movie. Cash saying, "I just felt like I was at the end of the line. I was down there by myself and I got to feeling that I took so many pills that I'd done it. That I was going to blow up or something. I hadn't eaten in days, I hadn't slept in days, and my mind wasn't working too good anyway. I couldn't stand myself anymore. I wanted to get away from me. And if that meant dying, then okay. I took a flashlight with me into those caves, and I said to myself, I'm going to walk and crawl and climb into that cave until the light goes out, and then I'm just going to lie down. And so I crawled in there with that flashlight until it burned out and I laid down to die. I was a mile in that cave, at least a mile. And by the way, this cave is filled with over 100,000 bats. But I felt this great comforting presence come over me. And it was saying, no, you're not dying. I got things for you to do. And so I got up, found my way out. Cliffs, ledges, drop-offs. I don't know how I got out. Except God got me out. Not in the movie. How does that happen? How does that happen? Well, I think we know how that happens. His love for June is all over that movie, but not his love for Christ. And he loved June because of her almost perfect love for Christ. He said it over and over again. Here's another story that wasn't in the movie. This may be my favorite. In August of 1969, hundreds of thousands of young Americans gathered in Woodstock to catch this concert that at the time no one knew would be Woodstock. I mean, it turned out to be one of the great concerts of all time. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Creedence Clearwater, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. You name them, they were there. Sly and the Family Stone. It was everybody. Kris Kristofferson had wanted his buddy Johnny Cash to go. Johnny had a show at this time on CBS. And he generally loved to introduce all kinds of new musical acts. We'll get into that in the next segment. His first time ever. His two musical guests were two kids named Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. So he loved musicians and he loved celebrating them. But on this particular night, and by the way, that was ABC, not CBS, but on this particular night, he decided to close out his show with one of his favorite gospel songs. And let's take a listen.
Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Causes me to tremble.
But perhaps his most famous recordings were ones he made in prisons, especially his two shows at Folsom Prison. Cash seemed at home there. He didn't see himself as better than those men. He was just one of the guys. He understood the prisoners in ways they realized without him ever saying anything. It didn't hurt that he'd written some of his best songs from the point of view of condemned and convicted men. Again, a sinner. He related. The inmates loved him for that. Actually, America loved him for that.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
Bono once said of Cash, he doesn't sing for the damned, he sings with the damned. And that was the true mark of Cash's Christian faith, the empathy he had for men and women, often overlooked in our society. When Cash got serious about his faith and left the women and alcohol behind, some of his old friends were not very happy with him. Quote, "They'd rather I be in prison than church," Cash admitted. Waylon Jennings was especially tough on Cash, according to Turner, accusing him of selling out to religion. He'd be attacked by agnostics and atheists if he appeared too pious, explained Stephen Turner, his biographer, and he would be denounced by the religious community if he appeared too worldly. Talk about a tough line Cash had to walk. But he tried to walk it. Cash was once asked how he was able to reach so many people with his message without ever hiding his faith. He had a simple, superb answer. I am not a Christian artist. I am an artist who is a Christian. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. The life of Johnny Cash, born this day in history in 1932. We're telling you the story like no one else is. When we come back, more of his music.
And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey.
Well, about the time my daddy left to fight the big war, saw my first pistol in the general store. In the general store when I was 13, thought it was the finest thing I ever had seen. I asked if I could have one when I grew up. Mama dropped a dozen eggs and she really blew up. She really blew up and I didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. She really blew up.
And that's Johnny Cash covering the great Steve Earle song. He loved the younger writers. The younger writers loved him. In fact, perhaps Bob Dylan's best record, Nashville Skyline, my favorite. He does a recording of North Country Girl, his song, with one of his heroes, Johnny Cash, and here's what it sounded like.
If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
See for me that her hair's hanging down. It curls and falls all down her breast. See for me that her hair's hanging down. That's the way I remember her best.
And that was Johnny, about as good as he sounded. There was a period of time in the 70s and 80s when he sounded like a Johnny Cash cover artist. I saw him at the Lone Star Cafe twice. Once it was very sad, and I didn't get it. And I walked out, and he was on something, and it sounded terrible. And then I saw him again in a more acoustic setting, and I'd never seen anything like it. And we're going to get to that in just a bit. Well, we wanted to talk about Johnny's talent as a storyteller. Because, boy, was he a storyteller. And I don't think he does it better than in this song that we all know. And let's hear a bit of it.
I want you to, if you don't mind, Carl, I'd like you to stay out and help us on some songs. Play the guitar.
I'd love to.
One of the greatest guitar players as well as songwriters and singers in the business.
Thank you.
Appreciate a little help on the guitar, all right?
Love it.
Thank you, Carl. Well, my daddy left home when I was three, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fists got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I'd just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a brew at an old saloon on a street of mud. There at a table, dealing stud, sat the dirty mangy dog that named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother'd had. And I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye. He was big and bent and gray and old, and I looked at him and my blood ran cold, and I said, my name is Sue, how do you do, how you gonna die?
And it just goes on. In fact, stopping this song is really hard to do, but what a story, what a storyteller. And in 1999, a bunch of artists got together in a star tribute to Johnny, and Bruce Springsteen, who had actually inspired Johnny, and Johnny covered several of Bruce's songs, Highway Patrolman, State Trooper, from the Nebraska record. Bruce did an introduction before he performed a song. Let's take a listen to that intro.
Johnny, I want to send out a big thanks for the inspiration. You kind of took the social consciousness from folk music and the gravity and humor from country music and the rebellion out of the rock and roll and taught all us young guys that not only was it all right to tear up all those lines and boundaries, but it was important. And this was a song I loved from the early recordings for a long time. I hope you like it.
And then Bruce covers it in a way, ultimately, just him and a guitar, that would bring Rick Rubin and Johnny Cash together to do just the same. Take a listen.
Found him by the railroad tracks this morning, I could see that he was nearly dead. I knelt down beside him and I listened to the words the dying fellow said. He said they let me out of prison, been frisked up. 10 long years I paid for what I'd done. I was trying to get back home to Louisiana just to see my Rose and get to know my son. Give my love to Rose, won't you, mister? Hey, give her this money. Tell her to buy some pretty clothes. Tell my boys daddy's proud of her. And don't forget to give my love to Rose.
Tell my boy my daddy is proud of him. Something I think Johnny always wanted to hear from his own dad. Bring my love to Rose, one of my favorites, Bruce's favorite. And then a little bit later, Dave Matthews comes out with Emmylou Harris, and take a listen.
Well, I spoke not a word, though it meant my life. For I lived in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks these hills and along that lane. She visits my grave when the night gives way. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me.
And as Bruce had said, that's what Johnny did. He broke down walls. And think about the artists who loved him and admired him that night. Everybody from Bruce Springsteen to Bono, an Irish rocker, an American rocker, Snoop Dogg, Trent Reznor. All of them openly admired this openly evangelical Southern man. And all because Johnny dared to smash stereotypes, transcend musical categories, and share himself with the world, for better or for worse. And I gotta say, especially for worse.
I hurt myself today.
And when we come back, you're hearing Johnny sing the Trent Reznor song, Hurt. We're gonna talk about this unique relationship between Cash and his producer, Rick Rubin. And it is special, and you've never heard this before. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. On this day in history, in 1932, Johnny Cash was born.
Familiar sting. Try to kill it all away. But I remember everything. What have I become?
Delia, oh Delia, Delia all my life. If I hadn't shot poor Delia, I'd have had her for my wife. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And that MTV video and that American recording song, Delia's Gone, put Johnny Cash back on the map. He'd bumped into a guy named Rick Rubin, who was a producer of the Beastie Boys and some heavy metal bands. But, well, he was drawn to this guy. Just drawn to him. And we're lucky enough, Jesse did some digging and found an interview between Rick Rubin and Johnny Cash. And what had happened at Cash was he'd sort of become a, well, let's sort of just say a cover act of himself. And he had lost touch and contact with that original artist, those original feelings back in that Sun studio. And between the drugs and some bad decision-making, I think he had lost himself as an artist. And it took this young Buddhist, because Rick Rubin was a Buddhist and is, to get him in touch with his, actually, I think his faith, his songwriting, the guitar, and that microphone, and nothing else. Let's take a listen. From the documentary on the production of the American recordings of Johnny Cash, we hear this master producer, Rick Rubin, talking about how he realized that he wanted to work with this country legend.
Most of the artists that I had worked with at that time were all new bands and young artists, and I was thinking it'd be really fun to work with a substantial grown-up artist. And I started thinking about all of the great legendary artists and who may have been in a place that maybe either wasn't doing his best work or wasn't in a good situation. And Johnny was the first one to came into my mind of really legendary status, important, timeless artist.
Well, here's Johnny talking about his first recollection of meeting Rick Rubin backstage at one of his concerts and how they eventually started talking about recording together.
Rick Rubin called my manager, Lou Robin, and said he would like to talk to him about recording me. And Lou invited him to come to a concert. So he came to a concert a few miles south of Los Angeles. And I met him backstage. And we didn't really talk about me recording with him then. We talked about the record business and what I had been doing and what I hadn't been doing, mainly. But he said, I'd like to talk to you again. You know, it was getting late. So he came to another concert. And we sat backstage and talked, and he said, I'd like to record you on American. And I said, what would you do with me that everybody else has tried to do, you know, and couldn't? And he said, well, what would you like to do? He said, that's what I'll do. And I said, well, I would like to just take my guitar and sit down in front of a microphone and sing until I found the songs that I wanted to record, and then record them the way that I feel like they should be done. And he said, well, that's what I want. He said, I want to get the best out of you. Whatever you want to do, that's what I want to get on record.
How about that? What an idea. It can be that simple sometimes, folks. It can be that simple. Here, Johnny Cash and Rick Rubin talk about how they started recording in Rick's living room. What a smart move. Get out of that studio.
First thing that we did in working together was kind of reframe the record-making experience from making just another album to we're not done until this is the best album you've ever made in your life, and whatever that takes is what we're going to do. Okay. And it's like this is your first album.
It sounded like a dream come true for me because I had always wanted to record this way. I'd always wanted to. I have 25 years ago, I had a conversation with Marty Robbins. I said, I always wanted to record an album called Johnny Cash, Late and Alone. And I told Rubin this is what I really would like to do. And he said, let's do it. So we sat down and we made a deal. And I sat down in front of a microphone in his living room and went through my list of 200 or more songs and started singing them one after another. And we recorded them as I went along.
In this clip, Rick Rubin talks about how he wanted to show the real Johnny Cash. Johnny says it gave him a new enthusiasm, an enthusiasm he never thought he would ever get to experience again.
I was really interested in getting to the heart of who he was and really exposing that and showing the world who he really was.
Like about 18 and 25. It's given me an opportunity to express myself artistically that I never had before.
I wrote a letter to my uncle.
I drug out every old song that I ever wanted to sing, and I've sung them.
The Tennessee stud was long and lean, the color of the sun, and his eyes were green.
It's given me an enthusiasm and a new look at what my possibilities and capabilities are that I never thought I would get to experience.
Well, imagine that, a young man inspiring an older guy to get in touch with his original self, and maybe a self he never knew. Well, Cash says the reaction he got after a concert he did in the Viper Room in Los Angeles, because ultimately Cash had to test these songs out. And the Viper Room is a really famous small room in L.A., and Johnny gets up there with just the guitar, and he starts singing these songs alone, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. He has no idea what the reaction will be. He's probably scared out of his wits, which is good. And, well, he plays, and the audience went crazy. They wanted more, because they were hearing this colossal talent. Really, almost for the first time, it sounded like. Here's Cash talking about the reaction he got in that room that night.
Well, the reaction was like the 50s all over again. It was like that kind of excitement, the 50s, you know, like I had freedom of choice in the studio. I did an album the way I wanted to, exactly the way I wanted to, the way it felt good to me, the way it felt good to my producer. And the reaction from the critics and the fans was beautiful.
To be free.
Well, let's take a listen to a couple of the cuts. Of course, the first, the most historic, his cover of Nine Inch Nails is in Trent Reznor's Hurt.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away.
And the lyrics just jump out at you. I hurt myself today to see if I just feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. Only an addict could have sung that song about addiction. Heroin, the drug of choice for Trent Reznor. Johnny Cash never did that, but it didn't matter. Here's Jesse's favorite, God's Gonna Cut You Down.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down.
And circling all the way back to that original theme, I wanted to read something that Stephen Turner closed out his book with, and then play the song. And here's how that book ended, A Man Called Cash. The realm that Johnny Cash lived in was clouded by pain and colored by grace. He had the ability to transform the rough and commonplace into objects fit for heaven, just as he had been transformed. Rick Rubin remembers him taking Ewan McCall's The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face and turning it from a love song into a devotional song. Quote, "He loved that," said Rick Rubin. "It came really natural to him. It seemed like his devotion for life came from his devotion for God." Again, an atheist talking about a Christian. This was not in the movie. Shame on the movie. Take a listen to Johnny.
The first time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes. and the moon and the stars were the gifts you gave.
This is Lee Habib, the life of Johnny Cash, born on this day in history in 1932.
And the endless sky, my love, and the first time ever I kissed your mouth.
Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, we keep the mics open when we're prepping. And one of the things we talk about, I think we talk about it more than all things combined, is food. Where are we eating? What do we just eat? What do we like? What do we don't like? We get in our worst arguments, and we have, let's just say, varying tastes and styles when it comes to food. And that brings us to our off-mic segment of the week. And it was today's talk just, not too long ago.
I was thinking about worst restaurants, because I was originally going to do Italian food.
And this is Hengler.
There's this.
The elitist.
And that needs to be exposed.
Well, yeah, in Italian food, you're probably thinking of Olive Garden.
Well, I'm thinking anything Italian. Spaghetti Factory, Macaroni Grill.
So much anger.
It's going to be Italian.
It's all awful.
I will take you on. I'll take you down to Chinatown. Oh. Let's go.
We're going right now.
You know, because I'm going to just stand up for the people. I'm going to
be
like Bill
O'Reilly. Just stand up
for the folks. And then, by the way, you can rip at me and go, Habib, you've never been to Olive Garden. Don't hit me with this standing for the folks thing.
No, it's those massive chains that usually get a very specific food, like Italian food, so wrong. Because it takes a certain amount of delicacy to pull off Italian food in the first place. You can't have frozen this and frozen that.
No,
and
it's got to be fresh. Everything's got to be fresh, or it's not Italian food. Let's do it. Don't talk. Don't speak anymore about it. Let's just do it.
Oh, I thought we were. We're rolling.
Oh, we're rolling? Yeah.
No, it's just that at the heart of it, Italian food, because if you go to any other restaurant, at the heart of it
But what's your premise? What's the premise?
That's my premise is that there's substance in everything else except Italian food.
Well, that's because
at the heart of
the chains, yeah. But if you go to a mom and pop, you're going to get some good Italian food.
No, okay, I know, but good is relative. Because
you just don't like Italian food?
Look, I was brought up in an Italian family. My mom cooks Italian food. She's a great, nobody beats her raviolis. Yeah. But inside the raviolis, meat. But I'm saying at the heart of Italian food is basically two ingredients, and that's
tomato,
soggy wheat, and basically seasoned ketchup. It's nasty.
That's crazy.
You know, no. That's
crazy.
It's so cheap. This is the scam right here.
Here's the elitist. It's so cheap.
It's a peasant food. What are you talking about? Of course
it
is.
So you hate Italian food because it's too cheap?
At the prom time every single year, everybody's going to take their date to an Italian restaurant because it's considered to be nice.
Romantic.
You can still get a steak at a good Italian restaurant. It's still going to have steak.
It's going to have steak, but at the heart of it is those two ingredients.
Pasta.
The sauce and the soggy wheat. And
it doesn't have to be soggy. What place are you eating at?
Well, it's not hard. It's all boiled.
Al dente pasta is soggy wheat?
It is. No. It's all soggy wheat. And this is my point, is the price that you're paying for this. It's such an incredible markup. It is, at its heart, soggy wheat and ketchup. And the overhead is a quarter, and they charge you $10.
I will make you some lasagna for free, and it will taste amazing.
You don't have to. My mom's is the best.
So you don't like a couple of things. You don't like the price. So you don't like that it should only cost $1, and it costs $10.
Yeah. And I think I see the scam to it. They're charging a lot so they can say, we're going to a nice place. But it's nasty at the heart. Hey, no.
You're wrong, man.
No. Here's my third point.
I was missing the third point.
The third point is this. Absolutely no nutritional value in those two ingredients.
Carbator.
It's just pure starch. And that's why all you see it has such a bad reputation for putting on weight on people because there is no nutritional content in this food.
How many fat Italians do you know? Overweight Italians do you know? Go to Italy. How many people are overweight?
I haven't been outside the United States.
Here's why it happened. It has to do with, remember we're doing the peanut butter proportionality
right,
thing?
Right.
Look, how my grandfather always served it. Fresh piece of fish cooked on a grill. Fresh vegetables cooked on a grill. And a little,
so far, he has not mentioned the soggy wheat.
And a nice, beautiful, small portion of absolutely fresh cooked homemade pasta with some beautiful fresh tomato sauce with garlic and basil.
Now you're talking five-star Italian restaurants. It's a whole different ballgame.
turn the table.
What I'm talking about here is your macaroni grills, your
that's not garden. Italian food. That's crap.
Your Olive Gardens. This is where 95%+ of the American people eat, and they can Buca di Beppo. This is where
consider. Now you're hating on people.
You can say
like
that about
Olive
any
Garden?
Restaurant chain, though. For the most part,
Olive
anything
Garden,
that shows up on a frozen truck is going to taste like garbage.
Olive Garden is the worst restaurant in America.
You're having
number two. Close second is Applebee's.
You want some more breadsticks?
Breadsticks. I'm with you on Applebee's, but have you had the breadsticks at Olive Garden?
I have had
That's the trick. They fill you up on the breadsticks so you don't get much in your meal.
The soup and salad deal is a great deal.
So, Jesse, it's Alex and me versus you two?
Notice I have not talked about
Olive Garden's an
taste.
Abomination.
But
they're two different categories. You go to a nice Italian place and you go to Olive Garden. Sometimes you just feel like Olive Garden.
I know, but you're arguing the taste of the breadsticks. That's like saying, have you tried a Jolly Rancher? Yeah, it's absolutely horrible for you. And they're not charging you $10 for Jolly Ranchers. I know the breadsticks taste good. Who cares?
Yeah, they give you 40 breadsticks.
So
you
do
the
Happy Tabby. So do Airhead candies. They melt in your mouth.
I love them too.
But, but I'm not going to eat them.
Olive Garden should be a drive-thru.
And Airhead candies are 10 cents a pop. These places are scamming everyone.
So what do you got up against pizza? That's Italian food.
It is, and it's the same thing. It's
you don't
it's
like
hard,
pizza now. You
it's
don't like
hard
America
wheat with ketchup on it instead of the sauce.
Some cheese.
Well, you gotta have real. You gotta have real sauce. You can't have that frozen nasty ass sauce. You have to have some. You have to have tomato paste. Or
right.
Something, you know.
No, again, I'm not saying that it doesn't taste good. I'm talking about
just overpriced.
I'm talking about what it does to you. Okay. What is, if you can right now, go on the computer and look up the definition of drug, okay? Uh-huh. And what it's going to basically say to you is something that chemically changes your body. And nothing does that more than food. And so what the question is with any kind of drugs, there's a prescription and they tell you how much to take and when to take them. With food, we think that, well, that's not a consideration, how much to take and when to take them. But it doesn't even matter when it comes to this Italian kind of food because no matter what you take, there's no kind of value in it. And when you take it, it's just garbage.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
What was that? It's a drug, and it's not going to give any kind of benefit to your body or your life other than make it and go, yum, this tastes good. Let me have some more of this garbage.
Hangler on a rant. That's sort of rant and off mic combined. This is Our American Stories, the crew talking about what we love talking about, food. More after these messages.
Scusi, babbity boopy.
Che cosa?
Peter, what are you doing?
Speaking Italian. Babbity boopy. Babbity boopy, babbity babbity.
Peter, you can't speak Italian just because you...
I was a rebel from the day I left school. Grew my hair long and broke all the rules. I'd sit and listen to my records all day, with big ambitions of when I could play. My parents taught me what life was about, so I grew up the type they warned me about. They said my friends were just an unruly mob and I should get a haircut and get a real job.
This is Lee Habib, and it's Friday, and we love playing that George Thorogood song and talking about first jobs. And today we're going to cover three, and Scott Viverman, Magic Johnson, and Lloyd Blankfein. Three very different guys, a professor, a ball player, and a banker. Well, let's take a listen. Here is our first clip from our professor, Scott Viverman, who teaches about the radio industry at DePaul University. And he was interviewed by one of his students, Joey Cortez.
My first job, this is back when parents would allow their children to have paper routes. This is back when people not only had papers delivered, but often those papers were delivered by children. So I used to get up in the morning. My papers would be waiting for me at the end of the driveway. I would have to wrap all the papers. The worst was when it rained because you had to put them all in plastic. So I had to wrap the papers, put them in plastic, put them in my bag, get my 10-speed bike out, and then ride around the neighborhoods in the dark, mind you, and deliver my papers without a phone, no way to contact my parents. So fortunately, I never got abducted or killed or anything weird like that. It was definitely an interesting experience learning to get up when I didn't want to get up. I learned to get motivated. I learned to be responsible because I not only had to deliver the papers, but then I also had to go and collect money. This is before like online payments and things. So I literally had to go around and collect the money from the people. And of course, they would, like, sometimes I'd know they'd be home, but they wouldn't answer the door because they didn't have the money or whatever. So, yeah, it was a really eye-opening learning experience as a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid to be delivering papers at 6 o'clock in the morning before school and then having to go around and ask adults for money afterwards. So I definitely think it taught me some level of responsibility that a lot of my friends didn't have. It taught me how to talk with, how to deal with adults at a very young age, which I also think has been an important skill to have over the years.
Yep. And that was my first job. I mean, my real first job was at Roy Rogers, but my first job was as a paperboy with Paul Biatini. And I was the collections guy. He did delivery and I collected the money because he couldn't talk to people and he hated it. He hated it.
Collections must be tough in Jersey.
It's very tough in Jersey.
Muscle.
Yeah, but you know what? I just figured I would use my youth and my desperate nature to get it. And
you have so cute cheeks.
I had cute cheeks and I just made him feel guilty. I just made him feel guilty and I begged.
You have to go to confession over this.
That's right. And at the tips, it was all about the tips too. So you had to put the paper in the right place. So my buddy would just throw it at the end of the driveway. I would just get really mad at him because I'd say, no, just walk it up to the door. We get better tips. So anyway, that's great job by Joey. Let's listen to, Viverman told Joey how he got into radio.
My first job in radio was at 92.5 WDEK in DeKalb, Illinois for $5.50 an hour. And I got that job. So I was in school. I put together a demo tape. This is back when we still had tapes. So I put together this demo tape. I sent it out to like 100 radio stations. They were the first radio station, maybe the only radio station that really offered me an actual job. I went out, I interviewed. Eventually, I ended up moving there because it was just too long of a drive. And at that radio station, I got to do everything. So I did radio sales. I produced my own commercials. I DJed on the FM station. I engineered on the AM station. I used to do Chicago Bulls games on the AM station. So in that, like, 8 months or so that I was at WDEK, I really learned more about how to do radio in the real world than I ever did in broadcasting school. I learned a lot of theory in broadcasting school, but the actually being at a radio station and doing live radio and being prepared for anything, that's really what I got from that experience.
And that's what we learned time and again. The younger people work, the better, and nothing replaces work for your learning curve.
Can you believe that, too, from a professor saying that he learned more on the job than in school?
It's something, isn't it?
Adam Carolla had a pretty famous story where him and Dr. Drew were teaching or giving a speech at a famous college, and somebody got up and asked them about like getting a communications degree, and they said, it's worthless. Don't even bother. It turns out they were speaking at a communications college, and the entire student body was there hearing this message of don't bother with communications. Just get into radio. Be an intern or something like that.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
So let's hear from Magic Johnson. Let's hear from him, well, about his first job, and also let's hear him on his parents.
First of all, I was blessed to have both my parents who instilled their values in me and always pushed all of us in terms of education and also that anything in life we were going to get or receive, we had to work very hard for it. And they set the example. I saw my dad go to work for General Motors 30 years. My mother worked for the school cafeteria. So when you come from a family of 10, six sisters, three brothers, and you wanted to do something like go to the movies, you already knew the answer was going to be no. So coming from Michigan, it snowed a lot. So my dad said, I'm going to help you, though, even though I said no, I'm going to help you get the money so that you can go to the movie. There's the shovel, the rake, and the lawnmower. Go at it. So I went door to door and knocking on people's door. I was praying for snowstorms all the time. And sure enough, in Michigan, we got a lot of them. And so I used to dig people out of their driveways. I used to shovel snow and then also during the fall, rake leaves. And, of course, in the summer, cut people's lawn. My father had another job, which was a trash hauling service. So we used to go by people's homes and pick up their trash. And this is what really turned my life around, this lesson here. So I would only work with him in the wintertime on Saturdays because I had to go to school. But on that Saturday, it was like a snow blizzard, and it was must have been 10 below zero in Lansing, Michigan. My job was to get outside the barrels and pick up all the loose trash. And so this day it was so cold that I picked up just enough, threw it on the trash truck, and ran back in and jumped in the cabin. By the time I closed the door, he had grabbed me, drugged me back through the snow, and said, Irvin, if you do this job halfway, you're going to practice basketball halfway. You're going to do your homework halfway. He said, you have to do every job better than anybody else. So I became a perfectionist after that day. So everything I did after that was at the best level, highest level, and I owe all of that to my dad. So now, as I'm playing basketball, I became a perfectionist. I wanted to do everything the right way. And as a father, I want to be a father the right way, on and on and on. So I thank my dad for every life lesson. Even today, he's my number one hero. You know, I admire him. I look up to him. And the only reason I'm sitting here today is because of both my mom and dad. I have her smile. And so I want to save the world like her. And I'm tough and strong and a workaholic like my father.
Mike.
And there you have it. I don't think you could say it better. And then last but not least, the banker. Lloyd Blankfein's story is told on Job Creators Network's great website, informationstation.org. Lloyd Blankfein is the CEO of investment bank Goldman Sachs. Corporate events and conference calls didn't run in his blood from the start, but New York always did. You see, Blankfein was born in the Bronx to a mailman and a receptionist who raised him and his sister in the Linden Houses, a public housing project in Brooklyn. From an early age, there were two things on Blankfein's mind. His favorite baseball team, the New York Yankees, and the best way to make a living. This led the young fan of baseball to old Yankee Stadium, which is in the Bronx, where he found his first job. Oh my goodness, is this a great one? A concession vendor at Yankee Stadium. I would have paid to do that. Selling soft drinks and peanuts in the upper decks was his first major responsibility, and Blankfein realized he had to take it seriously. The job was all commission-based, meaning no guarantee of personal income. This meant walking up and down the bleachers for a 10 or 11% commission on a soda selling for 25 cents, a profit of less than 3 cents per soda by Blankfein's estimation, but he kept climbing for extra cash and the independence that came from it. It's character building for yourself, Blankfein finally recalls. And this all guides him to this day. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College. Hillsdale is the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and all things that matter in life. And if you're thinking about sending a child to college, there is no better place. I've spent many, many days there and even gone into some of the classes. And what an experience it's been for me. I went to a really good law school. And when I took the Constitution and American History classes that Dr. Larry Arnn taught, my goodness, I wasn't ready. Well, today you're about to hear a story about a person you definitely know, but actually you don't.
Not a continent in the world where people don't wear Levi's and have that little patch on the back with his name on it.
He had a wonderful spirit, and that made him so extraordinary.
The Levi's brand is one of the bedrocks. It's just the bedrock of American culture.
There's a symbol so tied to America, and we all have owned a piece of it. America has lived its life in jeans, blue jeans, Levi's blue jeans. After all, blue jeans have become a metaphor for America itself, especially Levi's. This is the story of how Levi Strauss threaded, stitched, and wove his iconic product into the fabric of America. Loeb Strauss was born in Bavaria on February 26, 1829, as the fourth child of Jewish parents who were peddlers, a profession relegated to Jews by Bavarian law. When Loeb became a teenager, his older brothers immigrated to New York City and immediately began sending back letters encouraging the rest of the family to make the move to America.
America is a wonderful country. One can achieve success through careful attention to business and hard work, although our earnings are modest.
Listen, I'm our brothers. And no laws hostile to Jews. We are already very happy and become happier and happier every day. We have also made some modest money. Be courageous and follow us. Big hugs from Jonathan and Littman.
Following the death of Loeb's father in 1847,
Father?
The 19-year-old Loeb, with his mother and sister, traveled on board a German immigrant sailing ship for 7.5 arduous weeks to the land of the free. Where his older brothers have been operating for 4 years. Here's New York University historian Hesia Diner.
In the United States, nobody cared. Synagogues could do whatever they wanted. There were no attempts by the government to regulate or control the inner life of the Jews. It was up to Jews to do whatever they wanted. And it has been described that what raged in Bavaria in the 1820s, 30s, 40s was America fever.
The newcomers squeezed into the tight, dark quarters of the Strauss brothers' New York City apartment on Canal Street. It is here in Manhattan where jeans boutiques are lined up one after the other. Loeb Strauss began his unstoppable rise to become one of the greatest American industrialists. On January 24th, 1848, gold is discovered in Northern California.
One of us needs to take a first-hand look at the market out there.
Phil Anschutz writes in Out Where the West Begins that Strauss planned to get rich by exploiting market forces instead of prospecting for gold. During the gold rush era, he writes, There were more prospectors than there were tents, shovels, pickaxes, buckets, and pans. The state of California was completely settled within 3 years.
Well, then what are we waiting for?
For you to go to California.
But before Loeb Strauss went west, he became an American citizen. He swore an oath to the American Constitution and renounced the Bavarian king forever. At about the same time, he started going by the name of Levi Strauss. Here again is Hesia Diner.
So for this young man to come and want to be able to communicate with his customers, to say I'm Loeb Strauss may have been more difficult than to say I'm Levi Strauss. I'm not sure I'd want to say that this was a step towards assimilation, because he's keeping his Hebrew name, but it's a way of adaptation to the American circumstance.
Levi Strauss took a steamship from New York City through Panama, and at 24 years of age, opened for business as a wholesale trader to the San Francisco gold miners in 1853.
Oh, what have you there that we can use? An old prospector asked. Canvas for tents, wagons, and sacks, but the miner he looked aghast. Too bad, the miner sighed. You should have brought us pants. Pants, why pants? Asked Mr. Strauss to the miner's saddening glass.
One of Levi Strauss' regular customers was the tailor Jacob Davis, a fellow Jewish immigrant residing in Reno. In addition to his daily business, Davis experimented with various sewing techniques in order to make the gold digger's work pants even sturdier. The 49ers valued the practical trousers from the tailor in Reno, but the pants would bust at the seams when they stuffed tools or rock samples in the pockets. Complaints from the customers' wives began to pile up, because only after a few weeks their husbands' pants would rip. In this crisis, the tailor came up with a sensational idea. Davis used copper rivets to affix the pockets to prevent tearing when the fabric was put under extreme strain. It is a stroke of genius. However, he didn't have the $68 to register the patent. Here's Lynn Downey, historian for Levi Strauss & Co.
He first went to Levi, and I think it's because Levi had such a reputation as a strong businessman, an ethical businessman, and someone who had resources. Even though Levi was not a manufacturer, Jacob thought that he could help him start this new part of the business. Levi and Jacob had a little trouble getting the patent. There were patents already for rivets in shoes, and the patent office thought that putting rivets in pants was the same thing and not a new invention. But they kept reapplying. And eventually, on May 20th, 1873, Levi Strauss & Co. and Jacob Davis received the U.S. patent for strengthening pocket openings with rivets. He could have said no to Jacob Davis. He could have said, you know, I don't have any manufacturing facilities. I've never done manufacturing before. I'll just stick with my dry goods. But he didn't do that. He had vision. And that's the kind of vision that makes you a pioneer.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Levi Strauss. We got through the first part. Hang in there and catch the second part right after these messages. Again, this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're continuing with our This Day in History, the life of Levi Strauss. And by the way, the similarities to the life of Irving Berlin, anti-Semitism drove him out of his home in Russia. And ultimately, this Jewish immigrant ended up writing White Christmas. And he was from Russia, but he wrote God Bless America. We're celebrating very often the life stories of so many of the great men who came here from the arts and from business. And we do that thanks to Hillsdale College, who brings us this day in history every day. And by the way, it was pointed out to me by Hengler, who did such great work on this piece, and also in Mr. Antrus's book, that in essence, Levi Strauss created the first brand. Before there was Coca-Cola, there was Levi's. Let's pick up where the story left off.
The rivet idea turned out to be a jackpot. The real inventor, Jacob Davis, became a floor manager at Levi Strauss Mercantile Business, which was now specializing in the manufacturing of dungarees. It was 1873, and the Levi Strauss brand was born. The first decision for Levi and Jacob was to decide what fabric to choose. Here again is Lynn Downey.
Men had worn denim pants, unriveted denim pants, for decades as workwear. So when Levi and Jacob decided to choose a fabric to make these new pants from, it made sense to choose denim. It was what men were used to wearing for mining and farming and if you were a cowboy or whatever. So it became the traditional fabric all the way, you know, to today.
Levi aimed to create consistency across the product line, writes Ann Schutz. The brand bore his name. It needed to have a reputation for quality. The childless Levi Strauss gave his nephews positions of responsibility early on. Now he needed their advice. In a few years, the patent on the riveted work pants would expire. What else could be done to make the durability of their pants more appealing to customers?
The durability of our
Levi's favorite nephew, Sigmund, proved to be an ingenious marketing expert in the discussion about the expiring patent.
Is the most gentleman, might I suggest this?
Sigmund, this is brilliant. This is exactly what we need.
The idea for the brand name was born.
To the brand.
To the brand.
Brand.
In order to accentuate the durability of the original riveted pants and to distinguish the product line from their competitors, Levi Strauss & Co. developed a leather sewn-on patch in 1886 with a two-horse brand, which is the company's trademark to this day.
In 1850, a man named Levi rounded up two stallions and hitched them to a pair of pants. Pants so tough, he promised a new pair free if they ripped. Yeah. Hey. To prove this, he set up his unusual demonstration. And he put this symbol on the back of every pair of original blue Levi's.
As Ann Schutz writes, consumers did not need to be literate to understand that Levi's were tough. Soon, profits from the production of pants surpassed all other earnings from the mercantile business. From 1890 onwards, all articles of clothing that are produced by Levi Strauss & Co. are systematically, consecutively numbered. The riveted work pants received the production number 501, which to this day is the designation for the classic style of Levi's jeans. The strength of the product is in its true to original form. The 501 line is not subject to any dictate of fashion. To this day, they are produced according to the traditional pattern and suggest to the wearer independence, freedom, and the American way of life. As the founder of the company, Levi Strauss grew older and enjoyed an ever-increasing popularity with his employees. Here's Lynn Downey.
His employees were instructed not to call him Mr. Strauss, but to call him Levi, which I think is very unusual to be that informal with his employees. Around 1960, someone here at the company interviewed a woman who had worked in our factory when Levi Strauss was still alive. And she said, "He was tough, but a fine fellow." And I think what that means is that he was all business. His life was about his business. And he wanted his business to run smoothly. He wanted to make a profit. And so he probably had very, very high standards. But the other side of that is the side of Levi that was such a philanthropist and was such a caring, giving person. So I think that he probably was very balanced. He was a tough businessman, but he was also a good person.
The success of this company has been built from hard work.
At 61, Levi Strauss retired from daily business operations.
The company will be left in all of your names.
And brought in his four nephews as joint partners. Anschutz writes, success granted Strauss more leisure time to devote to charity. He had always been a generous provider when he lived in San Francisco. He took special interest in orphans, helping to establish the Pacific Hebrew Orphan Asylum and Home. Although Strauss was Jewish, he contributed to causes across religious lines, supporting Catholic and Protestant orphanages as well.
Thank you, Uncle.
Education was also an important cause. He established scholarships at the University of California and gave money to the California School for the Deaf. Levi's death in 1902, at the age of 73, made headlines. San Francisco declared it a business holiday so citizens could go to his funeral, and the flags flew at half-mast. Just a few years after Levi's death, on April 18, 1906, the company's headquarters were burned to the ground due to the estimated 7.8 magnitude Great San Francisco earthquake. Here again is Levi Strauss and co-historian Lynn Downey explaining what happened next.
They didn't have to rebuild the business. They were wealthy. They could have just walked away, but they didn't. They rebuilt the business from the ground up, and they started from scratch, rebuilt the company, started making jeans again, started wholesaling the dry goods again, and continued the business in the name of their uncle.
Decades later, World War II would take the jeans to Europe.
During World War II, American soldiers would take their Levi's jeans with them, both to Asia and to Europe, and they would wear them when they were on leave. So this was the first exposure of Levi's jeans to areas outside of the United States.
In 1943, during World War II, the company registered a new trademark. The basis for the idea is the eagle, which is also part of the U.S. National Coat of Arms, symbolizing freedom and independence. The embroidered design, which is reminiscent of the flapping wings of an eagle, is stitched on the back pockets of the jeans. Levi Strauss never wore his own pants, and yet today, millions of people all over the world wear them and share in the American way of life. Levi Strauss. This day in history.
Great job on that, Greg. And there you have it, another great American story. Man comes here with nothing, builds something big, and gives much of it away. We hear that story over and over and over again. And just a couple of other facts. The zipper fly made its first appearance in 1954, and not everybody was thrilled. Someone allegedly wrote to the company asking, "Why the heck did you put a zipper in your jeans? It's like peeing into the jaws of an alligator." Little did he know how often this would become a problem. Also, Levi's weren't called jeans until the 1950s. Jeans used to be called overalls, which was the old name for workwear. But after James Dean wore a pair in Rebel Without a Cause, they became wildly popular. The kids wanted another name for overalls, though, since that was a term their parents used. So they started calling them jeans. The oldest pair of blue jeans in the Levi's archives are kept in a fireproof safe to which only two people know the combination. They were over 130 years old and are estimated to be worth $150,000. They don't look that much different from the ones today. And more than a century later, consumers worldwide wear blue jeans an average of 3.5 days a week and own 8.6 pair. And by the way, we will do more stories out of Out Where the West Begins as well by Phil Anschutz, because there are so many great ones. George Mortimer Pullman, Henry Wells and William Fargo, J.P. Morgan, Buffalo Bill Cody, Samuel Colt, Meyer Guggenheim, John D. Rockefeller, and Cyrus McCormick, and last but not least, Brigham Young. You know the names. We're going to cover them all over the next months and years to come. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and this was brought to you by Hillsdale College's This Day in History series.